This is, for the people who live in microphones, we're going to start now. This is Kevin O'Brien and Brian Knobs. Our second session, Energy and Ethics 102. If you weren't here for 101, you'll be fine, because the first thing I want to do here is just recap what it was we talked about yesterday. And those of you who were here yesterday are thinking, why did I bother? If they were going to do it in 5 minutes, why did I spend an hour? Sorry, no way to explain that away. Our topic is energy. And we're trying to use energy as a way to talk about environmental ethics. And we're trying to use energy to talk as a scientist and a Christian ethicist about environmental ethics. And we're committed to not having the kind of conversation where I say something as a Christian ethicist and Brian smiles and says something as a chemist, but where I have to engage chemistry and Brian has to engage Christian ethics. And we invite all of you to engage chemistry and Christian ethics. We started with a definition of energy that Brian gave us from chemistry, with a little economics thrown in, I think, which is that energy is the capacity to do work. And if you were here, remember he kept dropping the book, and the oatmeal was what allowed him to pick up the book. So energy is the capacity to do work. And energy, the second part of his definition, is fungible. You can change it. That's fungible is F-U-N-G-I-B-L-E, because some people didn't hear it, weren't familiar with the word. Fungible starts with fun. you can change it. You can do different things with the same energy. It's flexible. It's changeable. It's adaptable. So we talked then about two kinds of energy. We talked about natural energy. And Brian gave us a primer on this. Brian talked some about petroleum, some about natural gas, about hydropower, about nuclear power. Natural energy we're thinking of as the capacity to do work provided by the physical world, provided by stuff. We also talked about social energy. Social energy is the capacity to do work within, through, and upon human society. Social energy is about community. Social energy is about how do we join, how do we become part of and act as part of, and how do we change human communities. I argued a little bit, just to prove I was a Christian ethicist, that all energy comes from God. And I quoted this piece from Colossians, which I want to mention again. The author of Colossians is talking about the work of spreading the gospel. And he tells us, we assume it was a he who wrote it, he tells us what gives him the capacity to do that work. He writes in Colossians 1:29, "For the gospel I toil and struggle with all the energy that God powerfully inspires in me." So the energy comes from God, and it is the capacity to work, to toil and struggle. So that's the terminology we got out yesterday. And our project is to do an ethics of energy. Our project is to think ethically about social and natural energy and what they have to do with each other, how they interrelate. Somebody yesterday mentioned to me that I had done a really good job saying what ethics is not, but I had never said what ethics actually is. So I want to say to you that that was on purpose. That was to create some expectation and make you wonder and make you think about what could ethics be. That's what I want to say. The fact is it was written in small handwriting and my handwriting is very good, so I forgot. Ethics, I want to define as conversing about what we must do when we aren't sure what we should do. And I want to flag three things about that definition. It's conversing. Ethics is a conversation. Ethics isn't about one authority telling us what to do. It's conversing. In the Earth Ministry session earlier today, Caitlin had this really helpful discussion about why Earth Ministry has this program for greening congregations, because it's an ongoing process. And so I went to my bad handwriting and changed this slightly to conversing, because ethics is an ongoing process. Ethics involves uncertainty. It's about what we do when we don't know what we should do. If we knew what the right answer is, we wouldn't have to have the conversation. So ethics is the conversation we have when we aren't sure. And then the last thing I want to flag is it's about action. We have this conversation, we do ethics when we must do something, even though we don't know what we should do. So ethics is conversing about what we must do when we aren't sure what we should do. So I can cross that off yesterday's list of things to do. That's hard work. Those conversations are really difficult. And so to make those conversations more possible, we're trying to create, with this ethics of energy, some frames, some language, some vocabulary, some tools to talk about what we must do when we don't know what we should do with our natural energy, with our social energy. So I want to give you another tool to help sort of frame the work of today. And this tool is a triangle. And up here is economic. And over here is social. And over here is technological. Now, to get a sense of how many of you are familiar with this triangle, I want to ask, how many of you heard Brian's series last week? How many of you have heard Brian speak before? How many of you have, like, been in the same room with Brian for more than 5 minutes? You've probably seen this triangle. This triangle, Brian calls a sustainability triangle. Many people call it a sustainability triangle, and it's a great triangle. I'm glad he's spreading it around. And what it emphasizes is that when we want to talk about environmental issues, when we want to talk about what is sustainable, what should we do to be sustainable, we can't just ask one question. We have to ask a technological question. What can we do? What's possible? We have to ask a social question. What do we want to do? What do we hope for? And we have to ask an economic question. What is it practical for us to do? Without asking all three of those questions, we haven't finished the work of environmental ethics. Each of these terms, I want to emphasize in the context of something we talked about yesterday. We want to see these in a big enough way. So I asked Brian, why technological and not scientific? And he said, science is narrow. Science is research. Technology is what do we do with what we know. Technology is bigger. It's a bigger question. Social, I want to see as social is not just the interaction between two people. It's not just the interaction in one community. It's all human communities, all human relationships. We have to think big about social. I also want us to think really big about economic. I talked a little yesterday about how I worry that we think kind of narrowly when we think in economic terms. When I say what's practical, I don't just mean what's cost effective in dollar terms. I mean, what can we do? Economics, many of you, I'm sure, have heard before. If you've been in the room with me for more than 5 minutes, you've heard. Economic, the root of economic, eco, same root as the word ecology. Same root, incidentally, as the word ecumenical. And the word oikos means home. Ecology is words about home. It's how a system works, how an organism interacts with its environment. Economy is rules about home, how you manage a household. And that, I hope you agree, is much bigger than dollars and cents. It's about rules and structures and institutions. This is about the frame we build in our communities to manage our lives. That's what I mean by economic. So these are four questions we have to ask. We have to ask, what can we do? We have to ask, what do we want to do? And we have to ask, what is it practical for us to do? That's a tool for ethics of energy. I want to talk a little more on another day about who this we is. Who do we mean by we? But that's not today. Today, we want to use these three questions to frame a discussion that started yesterday. We were really excited by the hands that went up when we finished yesterday, and we want to continue the discussion. Particularly, we felt like there was a lot of energy around this question of what's the role of the church in environmental discussions? What's the place of the church in environmental discussions? And we want to continue engaging that question, which it seems like lots of people want to talk about. One way of going forward with that question would be to say, where does the church fit on the sustainability triangle? Does the church just fit here? Or does the church get to say something about here and here too? So that's one way to ask that question. I want to just make sure you notice Social's over here, the social, natural's over here, technological. Economic is right in the middle. Economic involves both social energy and natural energy. It's where the two meet. It's how we bring our social energy into conversation with our natural energy, the natural energy available to us. So this is part of our frame for today to talk about. What's the church's role? The other thing we want to do is we want to have a little bit more focused discussion about what the church's role is. So we're going to focus today on hydrogen. On hydrogen as an energy future, as a possible energy future. Now, to do that, we need to understand hydrogen chemically and hydrogen technologically. And if we want to do that well, I have to sit down and Brian has to stand up. So that's what's going to happen now. Please.
Okay, just before I talk a little bit about hydrogen, maybe a place to start is why hydrogen? For today, tomorrow, and Thursday, we've picked hydrogen, biofuels, nuclear power as three sort of examples to work through. And the reason that we chose these three was these are all existing technologies. This is not sort of pie in the sky stuff that may or may not work. If you wanted to, you could go to California today and buy a Honda FCX hydrogen fuel cell car. Went on sale last week. So it exists. Biofuels, we know, exist. Nuclear power has been around for a while. All of these are at a sort of perhaps introductory stage in our society. All three of them have the potential, should we choose, to become much larger parts of our kind of energy input streams. One of the things that we hope to do in each of these days is at least start a conversation about what do these futures potentially look like, what sort of voice should we have in shaping these energy sources, and also some of the discussions around the unique ways that each of these sources of energy might be used. Remember, energy use, energy sources, you know, they're both pretty flexible. I like the word fungible. So hydrogen as an example of a new technology that our decisions over the next 10-15 years are going to shape. So what does this technology look like? What does this end game look like? And perhaps even if it's a wonderful game, how do we share in that end game? So first let's talk a little bit about hydrogen. What is hydrogen? This is a new crowd to me. How many of you have had a chemistry class at some point in your life? All of you. So you all know what hydrogen is. All right, great.
I know.
Okay, so hydrogen is a very small molecule. When a chemist says hydrogen, they're actually thinking about H2, two hydrogen atoms that come together to form a hydrogen molecule. An interesting thing about hydrogen is it's something we generally make. There's not a lot of it around, so it's relatively easy to make. We can make it in a lot of different ways. I'll talk more about the fact that how we make it has different consequences. Talk about perhaps the future of what the cost of making these things is. But hydrogen is something that we've known how to make for a long time. And there's reason to believe that we can figure out how to make it better. But hydrogen as a gas is the reason chemists like it probably twofold. We think of hydrogen as an energy storage device. So like, rule one, if you walk away from this discussion with nothing, hydrogen is not an energy source. Hydrogen is a convenient way of storing energy. And the reason hydrogen is not an energy source is we can't go out and we can't pump some hydrogen up out of the ground in general. We have to make it. And so the true energy source is what did you make the hydrogen from? Which is an important thing to think about. So chemists like it because it's a convenient energy storage device. The reason it's a convenient energy storage device is a little bit carries a lot of energy. Remember the book example. If we think of one of the ways of making hydrogen is making it from water, So water would be the on a chemical level, water has this much energy. We put energy into it, we make hydrogen. So now we've got the energy stored in lifting water up. Oh, we've got the energy stored in hydrogen. We can do things. A little one aside is, I think the energy stored in hydrogen is probably the reason I'm a chemist today. I have this significant emotional event associated with hydrogen. It's a good demonstration of how hydrogen is a wonderful energy storage device. I had this wonderful eighth grade chemistry teacher, Mr. Miller, Maywood Junior High School. I won't give you the year because I don't remember. So eighth grade chemistry class. It was my first chemistry class, and he decided he was going to demonstrate how hydrogen stores energy for us. So he decided to reenact the Hindenburg disaster. It's a really effective demonstration. So it turns out if you want a little bit of hydrogen and you have your chemistry lab, it's fairly easy to make. Some acid, some metal, bubble some hydrogen up. So he had one of these clown balloons, that you can turn into a dog. So he made he filled this balloon full of hydrogen. It was a pretty long balloon. I remember thinking, wow, that's a big balloon. It's packed pretty hard. The way this room was set up was there's a demonstration bench in front, student desks, lab in the back. He had the presence of mind to tell students to scoot the desk back, because as it became clear later, he hadn't really practiced this demonstration. He hadn't vetted it well. So he fills this full of hydrogen, goes off to the corner of the room, shuts off all the lights in the room after he's lit a Bunsen burner in the middle of the room, and he sails the balloon. And when it hit. And it was kaboom! This is a big bang. Knocked some of the acoustic tiles off the ceiling, shut off a few alarms. Of course, the students were like, do it again! So, I mean, that sticks in my mind. Years later. And so, hydrogen is a great energy storage device. Why are we excited about it? Different technologists maybe would gravitate toward different things, but I think one of the most... probably the most exciting notion around hydrogen is its use in a fuel cell. So for those of you who might need just a quick reminder what a fuel cell is, if you take a battery, if we're going to use a battery in a flashlight, typical alkaline battery that you put in to run your flashlight, it's a chemical reaction. It's a chemical reaction that produces an electrical current. In that case, it's a reaction between zinc and manganese dioxide. So we've got chemicals we put in, we do a reaction, we harness the electricity, we harness the chemical energy in the form of an electrical current. But what happens? The chemicals get used up, the battery runs out, the song is over. A fuel cell is just a battery with flowing inputs, right? So in the case of hydrogen, it's hydrogen fuel cells are very efficient ways to run a battery forever. Rather than letting it run out, you just kind of feed the feed streams in, usually hydrogen, oxygen, and it directly converts that chemical energy into electrical energy very efficiently. The reason we like hydrogen as an energy storage device is that it's not unique, but it's a very convenient fuel source for a fuel cell. It's probably one of the biggest issues. Why are we excited about fuel cells? Because they're so efficient. If you think about fuel cells as a potential for transportation, run a car or run a bus, a normal internal combustion car, where we're running gasoline or ethanol or whatever it is we're running into it and burning it with oxygen. The efficiency, if we think of it from an energy perspective, the amount of energy that we have that actually gets used toward moving this vehicle forward is about 20%. So about 80% of the the energy that's in the fuel gets wasted in the process of moving the car down the road. Fuel cells, the efficiency they're claiming for the Honda FCX is 60%. 60% of the energy, the hydrogen that we're going in, translates to moving the car down the road. It's an incredible gain in the utility of that energy, and that's probably one of the single biggest reasons that, you know, folks, the technologists are so excited about hydrogen, because of this efficiency. So the difference between using hydrogen in a fuel cell and the difference between hydrogen in a combustion mode, the Hindenburg is the combustion mode, right? The byproducts are heat, sound, light. And I mean, you could certainly burn hydrogen in some sort of internal combustion engine with oxygen, but you have all these energetic byproducts that aren't terribly useful. The other reason that we like hydrogen is that in addition to being a good transportation device in a fuel cell, is that we can use these same fuel cells to generate electricity in a rural environment. Right? So if we think about energy storage, you can now think about storing energy in the hydrogen molecule rather than storing it in a battery. Right? So batteries are this kind of limited technology, if you will, big important technology, but the long-term potential might be using hydrogen and fuel cells rather than using chemicals and batteries. All right, so let's talk about how you make hydrogen a little bit. You want to pass these things on? How we make hydrogen is important. It's important because there are lots of different ways of making hydrogen that have lots of different potential consequences. What I'm passing out here is something that's got the triangle on top. By the way, this is not my triangle. The owners of the concept for the sustainability triangle, this comes from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the folks that have been teaching us about climate change for the past 10, 15 years. What I've got here is a figure that I took from a report that's down in the links piece. So anybody, I'm going to spend about another 5 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes talking about this. If you have any sort of technological interest or any sort of economic interest, and I would argue even some social interest in hydrogen as an economy, I would dig up this link. This is fresh. It's November 2007, and it's 334 pages long. Everything you ever wanted to know about DOE's plans with hydrogen is in this document, and it's a good read. It's very interesting. This is from their section on domestic hydrogen production options, and you can see. We'll start at the bottom. Any hydrocarbon, methane, gasoline, diesel fuel, anything that has carbon and hydrogen, in some way we can turn into hydrogen. The chemical modifications are relatively straightforward. So if you look here, you can see that some of the ways that we make our hydrogen would be from distributed natural gas or coal, and we've got with carbon sequestration there. Because if you make hydrogen from coal, one of the byproducts of that is CO2. So this is the classic sort of short-term problem. If you're thinking about hydrogen being made now, most of the hydrogen that we are going to run these Honda FCXs off of is from natural gas or coal. So it does have CO2 in that loop. Which isn't to say that's necessarily bad, because remember, you are making some CO2, but you're using that hydrogen really efficiently. You're gaining a lot of energy there. If you want an industry bias, absolute one, the fuel cells are the wondrous future. Here's the best that they could be. You can read this U.S. Fuel Cell Council link that I put there. It is a nice read. But it is from the U.S. Fuel Cell Council, so it's sort of a slanted read, but a very interested read. So let's go up to the top of this. If we go back to this figure that I've got here, we've got nuclear, we've got hydro, we've got wind, solar, geothermal, biomass. All of these things, in some way, can be made into hydrogen. One thing that's not on here that we heard about yesterday is would be biological production of hydrogen. Not in this part of the DOE report, but it's one of the things that is probably one of the nicest potential longer term technologies. So here you're using sun to take algae and have the algae make the hydrogen for you. Great technology, that would work. And so we've got lots of options to make hydrogen. I don't think we know exactly what the cost of these things are going to be. One thing's for sure is we have to make a lot of decisions as a society about how do we feel about these how do we feel about this technology. So, what are some of the kind of issues here? You know, obviously we need to produce hydrogen. We need to deliver it. Moving it around is a little bit more complicated than moving diesel fuel. You need to store it, you need probably better fuel cells. There's a whole mess of safety codes and other things that need to happen. All of these problems are solvable. But each one of them is another little sort of technological thing to work through that we as a broad society need to kind of just keep in the back of the mind. So the little piece here is if we have a hydrogen-based economy that is based on coal or natural gas, we're not really changing our energy inputs into the system. So what does that mean? What it means for me is absolutely we need to be a very clear voice that research investment to try and get to these renewable sources of hydrogen, this is critical. Right? If we let that opportunity slide, we're ignoring what is potentially a disruptive technology. I don't like to talk about magic bullets because everyone just wants to jump to the magic bullet. Oh, we don't need to worry about this. We got hydrogen. In my experience, I never trust a magic bullet till it's already hit its mark. So, let me switch to economics a little bit. One of the things that we think about, I think sometimes if you have an economic discussion with someone, we assume this notion of a level playing field in a capitalist society. Free trade, level playing field. I am not an economist by any sense of means the word. But I did spend actually 20 years of my life managing in a for-profit company in the chemical industry, so I'm actually fairly familiar with the economic realities of moving chemicals around and selling them. And I've never seen a level playing field. It's a ridiculous concept to me. There is no such thing as a level playing field. If we think about what we're doing right now, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but right now we've got $1 a gallon credit, blending credit for biodiesel. We got 50, 60 cents a gallon at least credit for ethanol. We have made a social decision that we are going to invest in these technologies and support them. That is not a level playing field. Again, maybe good, maybe bad. Maybe we need to support this technology so it will emerge later. Maybe. I think that this notion of a level playing field is just, it's an important frame that we need to understand as we talk about these technologies. I'll give you an example that I think works well. When I read through the DOE reviews of hydrogen, just trying to learn enough to teach a little bit about this, the frame is almost always not about, yes, there's technical details in here about fuel cells and how you make hydrogen, but the political capital, the political push is what? Anybody know?
Clean.
Nope. That is a nice byproduct. The political push is energy independence. This is why we're doing it. I don't think any scientist believes that. But if you listen to what our president has said publicly about the hydrogen economy, I have never seen a quote from him about the hydrogen economy that doesn't immediately talk about energy independence. It's about energy independence. This is the frame, right? The danger of that frame is that if we're not thinking about how these technologies fit together, we might allow an economic frame to say, energy independence is the key. Therefore, we have to have the cheapest hydrogen available, which, by the way, right now is from coal, without carbon sequestration. So how we feel about the economic reality, what is the value of energy independence, is really is something that I can't believe won't shape these technological decisions, at least in the short run. And I believe that these disruptive technologies come through, eventually they'll break in. But the rate that they break in is going to be how entrenched we are around our current nations. So no such thing as a level playing field. The economic framework that we put around things certainly pushes our technology buttons. Anything else useful to think about in economics?
Yes.
Oh. Why, yes, there is.
You'll notice if you have the outline or you can see somebody else's, what we're doing is we're talking about hydrogen first as a technological question, next is an economic question, and we'll move to the social question. Brian is a chemist, so he's talking about the technological question. I'm an ethicist, so I'm talking about the social question. Neither of us is an economist or a social scientist, so we're both talking about that. What I want to emphasize from what Brian has said about the economics of hydrogen is that this is about choices we're making, and it's about lots of different kinds of choices we're making. Again, notice that when Brian talked about economics, he talked about tax credits. Tax credits are dollars and cents, but they're political. And when we think about economics, we tend to narrow in and think politics is something separate. It's not, certainly not if economics is the rules of the household. Politics really matters. Sociology, how the community institutions are structured, really matters. So economics is a big, big tent, lots of questions under it. And it's about what choices are we going to make given the practical realities we face. It's about how are we going to balance, how are we going to bring together our social energies and our natural energies. We talk here on the handout about a hydrogen economy or hydrogen economies. And that's to frame one of these choices that we have to make about hydrogen. You see on the graphic from the Department of Energy, there's these two lines coming out of H2, one into transportation and one into distributed generation, which as I understand means the grid, right? That's electricity.
That would be local production.
That would be local production of electricity. So as I do not understand it, it means local production. But these are different uses. Do we want to use hydrogen to run cars? Do we want to use hydrogen to power our houses so that the lights come on? Do we want to do both? That's a choice we have to make about which parts of our social structures hydrogen fits into. But of course, that's not the only choice we have to make. And Brian gets to this with this talk about energy independence. Because that's not just a discussion about what's practical. And it's not just a discussion about what we can do. When we think about, do we want hydrogen because it makes us energy independent, we're asking a social question. We're asking, what kind of society do we want to be? Is it a goal for us as a society to be energy independent? Lots of the folks who talk about the hydrogen economy say yes. That's why hydrogen's great. Because we no longer have to worry about getting oil from overseas, about getting natural gas from overseas. We no longer have to worry about getting someone to accept our nuclear waste overseas. We are managing our energy here for ourselves. We don't need anybody else. That's one model of what it means to be a society. And I will admit my bias and say I don't think it's a particularly Christian model of what it means to be a society. We don't need anybody else and nobody else needs us doesn't sound like the gospel to me. But I want to talk more about that because I'm certainly, I'm trying to start a conversation, not make declarative statements here. What I do want to note as we're thinking about what kind of world do we want to live in, what would we want the hydrogen economy or the hydrogen economies to look like, is that we've had exciting new energy sources before. 120 years ago, we found some really great ways to use coal. And it did wonders in changing our society. 50, 60 years later, we discovered that petroleum was even better. And it changed our societies in some enormous and fundamental ways. I also want to talk about those a little more in a second, but first I want to just note, at each of these points, a choice was made. Not just a choice, a series of choices were made by people in societies. Understanding what they could do, understanding what was practical, people made choices about what they wanted to do. We wanted, we broadly construed our society, Western civilization, I don't know. We have to deal with this weed, it's just not going to be today. I had a professor once who was very stodgy, serious British guy. And whenever you would say, well, we need to, he would say, you're weeing all over the place again. Because he was trying to say, you don't say we without specifying. But I'm doing exactly that, and he's not here, so it's okay. We decided that coal made a lot of sense, that we should use the coal we had. We decided that petroleum was really useful, that we should use it. Those were decisions. 20 years ago, we started having a discussion about whether nuclear power was an exciting new energy that we should use to change things. That discussion is kind of still going on. But I need to save that for Thursday. At each point, we were making economic choice, economics broadly construed. Now, I regret very much that this morning I had garbology duty. Not because I had to actually do garbology or because of the smell. Those things made me feel manly and important. What I regret is that I missed all but the last 15 minutes of Pastor Story's discussion today. I regret that in general, but also in particular because this becomes sort of economics day, and he was talking about what the gospel says about economics. And what I heard in the last 10 minutes was about this distinction between an economy that values freedom and an economy that values equality. Now, we made economic decisions when we got our hands on coal and when we got our hands on petroleum. And this is a really easy question, I think. Did we make decisions that favored equality or favored freedom?
Of whom?
Say more.
Well, just because we gave freedom to some groups and took things away and ran with them and then deprived other people of freedom and their own choices.
That's right. We gave some people freedom. Did petroleum give people equality? I mean, you could argue. I don't think that was what anybody was really trying to accomplish with it, or not a significant number of people. We did not give everybody freedom with coal or petroleum. But what we used coal and petroleum to do was to make some people feel more free. I can drive 80 miles an hour on the highway because of petroleum. And that feels kind of freeing. I can get away from any place pretty quick, except Holden, because I'm not driving down that hill. So we made choices. And they shaped our society. This access to a new kind of energy shaped our social world. Just a quick list of some of the ways I think petroleum shaped our society. I mentioned this yesterday. We live on a continent that we generally see as vast rivers of asphalt. We have paved this continent in petroleum so that we could efficiently use petroleum to get around it. That's a change that this energy made on our society. We became incredibly dependent on a limited resource. We've always known there's only so much coal in the world. Almost all of us know that. And we decided that we wanted to use it pretty much until it was gone. We gave incredible power, enormous power, to the people who control this resource. We agreed that the people who control petroleum should control lots and lots of other things. We decided at some point that no one has a fundamental right to the energy produced by petroleum. That would be a privilege, that would be something you had to earn in some form, that nobody just got it just because. We also decided that the pollution and waste produced by petroleum, the emissions that come out of your tailpipe when you drive, are fundamentally everybody's problem. So we decided that some people would get the benefits and everybody would get the problem. Those are social and economic decisions we made about petroleum. The question that Brian and I want to get to about hydrogen is, what choices would we want to make if we're moving into a hydrogen economy? Do we want hydrogen to be a way to prop up the world that we built with oil, to keep that world going? Is that what we want? Do we want to use hydrogen to keep individual cars running on our rivers of asphalt? That's a genuine question. Is that what we want? Or do we want to use the power of hydrogen, to use hydrogen's capacity for work, to work on our society to change it, to do different things with this next energy source? That's a question that we need to talk about. It's a question we don't know the answer to, and you remember that's what ethics is. Talking about something when we have to do something, but we don't know what we should do. A couple other questions before we get to that conversation. Brian mentioned there's risks associated with hydrogen. There's costs associated with it. As we produce it now, with coal or natural gas, it creates pollution. Whose problem should that be? That's a choice we have to make. If we use it to run cars, we then have cars with a much more efficient source of energy packed really tight into them that I assume in the right circumstances could blow up like the balloon your professor threw at a plane. Who should bear the cost of that risk? Who should bear the cost of mitigating that risk? Whose responsibility is that? That's a choice we have to make. Who should get the benefits of a hydrogen economy? If we can do these things that the US Fuel Cell Council says we can, who should we do them for? And who first? If we can use fuel cells to create electricity, should we replace the grid in Seattle so that Seattle is running on a cleaner, more efficient source? We can stop increasingly using coal as our hydro source gets limited? Or should we take it to the lesser developed world where some people don't have electricity at all? Should they get hydrogen first if hydrogen is this miraculous new energy source? That's a choice we have to make. And it's a discussion we should be having so we're ready to make the choice when we can make that choice. Do we want energy independence? Do we want to use hydrogen to remove ourselves from this network of relationships around energy with the rest of the world? Or do we want to use hydrogen to create energy interdependence? Or do we want to use hydrogen to create something that might be called energy charity, where we figure out how to use hydrogen to create a cleaner, more efficient source of energy, and we give that away to China and India, the fastest growing economies in the world, to the lesser developed world, where, as I say, some people don't have electricity, lots of people don't have cars. Do we want to spread this technology around, or do we want to use it to separate ourselves from the world? That's a choice we have to make. Fundamentally, all these questions are asking, what kind of work do we want hydrogen to do? And I just say, we'll say again, I think the most basic question here is, do we want a hydrogen economy to sustain the world we have now or to make a new world? I think we need to know the answer to that basic question before we can talk about anything else. And I don't know the answer to that basic question. I don't know what we should do. I do know that we have to do something, that those of us who live in California get to decide pretty soon, if you can afford it, whether you want a hydrogen car. That lots of the rest of us will get to decide if we can afford it, whether we want a hydrogen car. That as hydrogen becomes, and Brian assures me it will, a more and more feasible source of energy, we're going to have to make big decisions about who gets it, who bears the costs. And so we need to start talking now to be ready to make those choices. As I said, we want to use this as a way to continue talking about the question that seemed had lots of energy around it yesterday, which was this question of what's the church's role? Does the church have anything to do with these big decisions about environmental issues? And if so, what? What are the limits of the church's role? What are the limits of other bodies' role that the church needs to enforce? So that's one way to phrase this question. And that's, I think, the way we want to throw it open and see what you all have to say. So let me ask you, what's the role of the church in making these decisions about hydrogen economy?
Yeah. The church, I think, in its best incarnation, has a capacity to help us keep asking the larger questions until they're large enough, in the way you talked about. Mm-hmm. And not all those other institutions have that capacity.
So the church's role, I'm going to put words in your mouth, but let me know, is to be sort of a gadfly, to say, we need to think bigger. You're not asking the right question yet. Is that?
Yeah, I think the board on the side, for one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are those things?
I think the market will basically make the decisions, and the role of the church will be to make sure that those decisions don't create some horrendous sociological problem for the world.
So the decision, there's some powerful decision here, and there's maybe some limits coming from the church over here.
Right.
Yeah, you're the two social and technological intellects here. What do you propose?
I think I want to speak for Brian, but you can correct me. We propose we have a discussion about this because we're not sure.
Is hydrogen as polluting the air, as much polluting the air as oil?
Can you say it a little louder?
Hydrogen use fuel cells pollute the air as much as oil does?
No.
Why not?
Well,
because if you use the oil to make the hydrogen, you're losing energy in the process. Why aren't you having more of a problem?
Okay. I had jumped to an idealized future. I had jumped to an idealized future. I took my own bait. You know, I think that if a hydrogen economy structured correctly is going to be a big deal, using dance terms, that it's not going to be based on coal, and that it would be something that would be a renewable, lower impact. The use of hydrogen in a fuel, I think the question was, if you use it in a fuel cell, does it pollute? No. As long as the hydrogen comes from sunlight and algae or some sort of clean electrical generation.
Yes, I was thinking, it really struck me when you said, Kevin, that an independent society is not a very Christian way of living. And I really agree with that. I had never thought of that. But and then I look at how we've not solved the social ills in this country because I think we've not had an honest and open conversation about it. And so it seems to me that the bigger question is not deciding energy, but the bigger question is having a conversation that's open, transparent, inclusive, that is there to address all of the issues, energy and others. Mm-hmm. And the role of the church could be the moral gadfly to promote that discussion does occur.
Thanks. And it's helpful to frame this as a conversation about energy, with maybe actually some conversation rather than anything.
I think the role of the church is always to protect the common good for everyone. And so the questions we have to ask are, if it pollutes, who pays? Because that protects the common good. And the question that is often very important to me is, who owns it? Is the technology owned as a nuclear by Westinghouse and a few companies? Or can everyone own a hydrogen cell so that it can be owned by a lot of people? So the church's role is to safeguard the common good.
Thanks.
I think it's the church's role to challenge the culture of overconsumption and seeing consumption as a saving grace. I don't see hydrogen or anything else being magical if it continues to feed the need to consume. Mm-hmm.
And so that, again, and I want to just notice here, a lot of what we talk about this is what's the problem, what's wrong? And if what's wrong is we're not having a conversation, then what we need to do is have a conversation. And what's wrong is we're not consuming. Well, I'm sorry, we are consuming way too much. Yeah, we need to consume more. What's wrong is we're consuming way too much. What's wrong is we're not looking out for the common good. Part of the reason I think this is so worth talking about is what I want to say to all of you is, yeah. And then we have to figure out, and what do we do about that?
I tell you one thing, no matter which way you're going to go, you're going to get all these radicals. I don't care what kind of energy you get. They're going to find something wrong with it. Nuclear energy, they tore us down to there. So they're going to find something wrong, whether they know about it or not. But it's some idiot's going to conjure up some pie in the sky, and you get a bunch of other idiots, and you got to spend all your money fighting them rather than doing the job.
Can we just stipulate the idiots? I agree.
I think good Lutheran theology would stipulate right. There are idiots out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to, that's part of the discussion. Hand back here.
Yeah. Actually a technical question, but it's hard for me to think about the uptake of hydrogen without asking a couple of technical things. One is about the efficiency. You mentioned 60% compared to 20% for the internal combustion engine. I'm just wondering, is that a realistic comparison because hydrogen isn't the source of energy in this case, it's the source of storage, and so how much energy then actually goes into producing the hydrogen, and then that brings in a whole other topic. My understanding is that the huge problem with hydrogen is the facilities to handle the hydrogen, to transport the hydrogen, to store the hydrogen. We don't have that in the country, and a huge amount of energy would go into creating that infrastructure.
I guess the first question about the energy comparison, I think it's a fair comparison, because gasoline doesn't just pop into the tank either. And so it's an interesting discussion about how do we value from an energy perspective, especially if you include social energy, what's the social cost of gasoline? What do you include? Do you include wars? I think there's a lot of interesting debates one could have about what the energetic cost of gasoline is, but I think it's also fair to say that especially if you move your timelines down 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it's clear that our petroleum reserves are going to be challenged. It's clear that there are other things we can do with them. I don't see how you could realistically make the argument that somehow petroleum would be more efficient. What's going to happen is, if we stay petroleum-based, we're going to spend more and more time with tar sands, with coal gasification, turning coal into gasoline.
All those
are efficiency losses. I've forgotten your second question. I'm sorry. The infrastructure. Infrastructure is a huge investment. There are some technical challenges there. I'm not an expert in the area, but I've never seen, I've certainly, as I watch the technology as an observer, I've never seen something that looks unsolvable. Probably, I think one of the things that most people would say was potentially the biggest problem would be this high pressure hydrogen in the tank. This Honda FCX, I think, has a 5,000 PSI hydrogen tank in it. The research on using metals as kind of hydrogen sponges to kind of suck up the hydrogen and release it as you need it, that research has been fast moving very quickly, and I think most people watching that area would say that that looks like an emerging technology that will work at some point. The infrastructure, I think, is more of an economic social thing than a technical thing, so I guess maybe that's the way to do it. You know, clearly, huge infrastructure need. Who pays for it? Who pays for it? Who owns it?
I love the ownership. Who owns it?
Right. And should the people who own it benefit from it?
Can I use that triangle to say something about this? I think probably it's clear that the church is not responsible for developing technology. So we can just say that. That's not the church's job. It is the job, of course, of people who belong to churches. Right? People who are developing, not everyone, but many people who are developing the technology belong to churches. So one of the roles of the church is to provide local and larger situations in which those people are reminded that their responsibilities are not only technological. Similarly, everyone who belongs to the church has some role. So one of the things that local and larger churches do is help all of us think about our individual choices. Shall I buy a hydrogen car? Shall I not buy a hydrogen car? And the churches make decisions about what they do as congregations. So they're agents as congregations. And then you come into traditional differences of tradition about corporate action by Christian people. Whether the church's role is to encourage and inform us as citizens active in the political process only, or if the church as an institution is an agent in the political process. So I think it's really important when we talk about this question to break it down a little bit and to see that there's a system or an ecology of how this thing works, and that the church has various roles, but not every role.
I think that it's just important that everybody, you know, the church definitely needs to be part of it, but everybody is a responsibility to keep conversing about this stuff, you know, whether it be hydrogen or nuclear, whatever it is, you know, as these technologies come about and things, you know, more research, you know, happens to support these, you know, these things that are being researched, because right now we know that we don't have an efficient way of life. We don't, and we can't, so we need to wean off of it, and by opening our eyes to new things and conversing about them. And the church has the ability to converse on a very large scale. It has a very quick ability to converse on a large scale. And I think that is the biggest thing that the church could possibly do, is keep that conversation there and, you know, maintain that with as many people in the congregation and have those people converse with other people outside of the church. That is, I mean, that's really all you can ask for, is just to keep the conversation going, and then hopefully enough people will be a part of it that we make a decision, or that people start leaning one way enough to support something. Because we can't rely on our government right now to make the right decision. We need social action.
I just wanted to piggyback on that briefly, because it made me think of something in terms of your very broad definition of energy that I think is helpful, which is, I think one of the greatest assets the church has, and I mean, it's not its only responsibility. I mean, if the church isn't preaching the gospel first and doing, you know, I mean, there's that part of things. But anyway, I think the asset that the church has is being a structure that is organized and has many people within it. It takes individuals' energy, and it builds up like a social energy. It kind of like brings the book up that much farther, I think, and has that much more social energy just within it, in theory, because it's organized. I mean, we all have different ideas. But it's just the potential energy within the church as an institution to engage the conversation. I think it's maybe just a paraphrase of what Lindsay said, is a great asset that the church has that would be, I think, it would be a great disservice to the conversation of the church to make use of it.
That's
great.
Just to bring together the last three things, I mean, I think what I'm hearing is the church has a responsibility to get members of the church doing more than just being part of the church. So the church is supposed to inspire something. The church is supposed to be involved somehow. It seems like is what I'm hearing. Do we have time for one more? I don't know.
We're at the hour. I think we should close, but let's close with two thoughts. One is, we'd like to invite you back to this discussion tomorrow morning, where we'll take on wheat, I think.
Yes, we'll take on wheat. We'll stop wheat.
And one thing that I think we collectively ducked, that my own personal bias, this is the most interesting question to me. Are we, our society that I think is built around massive energy consumption. People who were here last week would have heard me say, we are addicted to energy. I think a lot of the addiction frame works. Are we ready to even start a discussion about sharing? I mean, I think that's something that we should all kind of think about, and maybe we can pick up that timeline tomorrow. Thanks for your attention.